so interesting the ways that kink and polyamory or non-monogamy can like collide and fit so well with each other, and then in certain ways be really at odds. The way that kinky people do non-monogamy can be different or can be exactly the same. In kink, we can understand how people in negotiated specific roles can be happy in those roles.
My name is Abby, and I'm the voice behind the Evolving Love Project. In this podcast, my husband and I deep dive into the topics of non-monogamy and polyamory, drawing from our experiences of being consensually non-monogamous for almost a decade.
My name is Liam. Whether you're monogamous, polyamorous, curious, or anything in between, we invite you to join us for this conversation.
Let's begin!
Lena Doone is a 24/7 collared submissive, kink writer, podcast host, and a fairy submother to all who seek her advice. She is the voice, writer, and meme queen behind the wildly popular Ask a Sub, an online platform and community that explores mindful and consensual kink.
During this conversation, you will hear why so many people, including us, turn to her for wisdom, humor, and her compassionate take on all things BDSM. You can find all of Lena's work, including her writing, online community, and podcast at askasub.com.
In this conversation, we talk about her journey into kink, subspace, fake doms, red flags, unicorn hunting, couples privilege, the balance of feminist principles and submission, heteronormative scripts, the shame voice, and so much more. And with that, we bring you our conversation with Lena Doone.
Lena, thank you so much for joining us on the Evolving Love podcast. Really, really excited for this chat with you today. I've been following your Instagram for a number of years now, and I've been following your Instagram from before your account got deleted when you were at 115,000 followers, and then through that, you know, got onto your Substack and your podcast, and I'm just like absolutely thrilled that we're having this conversation with you today. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's such a thrill to join you, and thank you for acknowledging the trauma of the Instagram transition. The internet has been, as I'm sure you both know, very hostile to sexuality creators, and increasingly so. We're getting gentrified off of these platforms, and anybody who loves or cares about sexuality content needs to invest in it and support all of us. So that's my soapbox to begin with.
To begin with, I thought it be really interesting. A lot of people who listen to our podcast might not necessarily know the kind of ins and outs of BDSM. And you speak so beautifully on your podcast and through your incredible writing, kind of deconstructing the different elements of BDSM. But could we start with your perception of what BDSM is?
Yeah. So my perception is influenced by my sort of biases and position as a 24/7 submissive in a dom-sub relationship. So in short, that means that my relationship is underpinned by the structure of dominance and submission at all times. That's the 24/7 piece. It doesn't mean that I'm in shackles or in a cage 24/7. It just means that the way that my husband and I communicate with each other is inflected by the sort of separate and respected equal power roles that we inhabit and the ways that we've negotiated exchanging that power. So kink and BDSM can be practiced in a number of ways separate from that. Not all kink is done by doms and subs. Not all kink has to do with sadism and masochism. Not all BDSM is dark and leathery. People practice it in all kinds of different ways. But I would say the unifying factor of everything in kink is it is the first step that you take outside of what society has conditioned you to be normal and acceptable in terms of sexuality. And what BDSM is a legacy of safety practices that we derive from the queer community and have crossed over into other communities that can support that step into the taboo space, whatever it means for you to be stepping away from what you were taught was reasonable and acceptable and things that nice people do sexually. So that structure can have a lot to do with active consent and negotiation and aftercare and safe words. And we can get into all that as much as you guys want to. But it is the structural support for a journey outside the norms, I would say.
And so what was your initial kind of entry point into BDSM? Is this something that you've always felt within yourself? Obviously, now you're in this 24/7 dynamic. But I imagine when you first started off exploring these concepts and exploring BDSM, you weren't thinking, I'm going to be straight out the gate into a 24/7 dynamic.
Yeah. No, I think that my legacy with kink specifically, God, well, where do you begin? I think that the research shows us that kinks develop when you are coming online sexually and themes from your life, either as a teen or as a child or going into adulthood, like sort of themes get stuck in the crevices of your neuroscience and connect with those feelings of sexuality. And then we're born into adulthood with these various kinks, which I would think that probably everyone has a kink, whether they realize it or not. Mm-hmm. If you're having sex outside of heterosexual marriage for the purposes of procreation, you probably have something outside of that that you're interested in, and you could call that a kink. For some people, it's balloons and feet, and for other people, it's bondage. And you just, you know, it depends on who you are and how those things develop for you. I grew up in my teen years. I was in a very restrictive subset of Christianity. I'm sure you guys in Australia know about like Hillsong. It was very like that brand. And I felt this like, I think that especially that brand of like cool Christianity is extremely like sexy without meaning to constantly. Like, I think that there's definitely like a piece of like, give all of your thoughts and your sexual feelings to Jesus and he's watching you all the time. And like, I think that is translated over for me into dumb sub play, like pretty one-to-one. So as an adult, when I was seeking this out, I think based on the position that I occupy on the internet as this out and open sub, people would think like I was like, okay, I'm empowered and excited to do this thing. And here's my little safety checklist and I'm going to go get what I want. I was so scared to enact this. Like, I would match with people on the apps who said they were kinky, and I would just completely freak out and unmatch with them because they were like communicating openly about their needs, and that was something so foreign to me that it just didn't feel safe. So kink, I think, really for me started out as a problem. Like, I need this thing to feel sexually interested or seen or good, and I don't know how to get it without being terrified. So it was through this very long process of trial and error that I finally learned to sort of claim that and go after it in ways that were healthier for me without all of that religious shame getting in the way and societal shame and everything else. So it was, yeah, it was sort of groping around blindly in the dark until I accidentally found the solution to what had started out as a problem.
So it sounds like through your journey through kink, you've been able to like do so much sort of healing, you know, within yourself and learning about who you are, you know, as a person and being able to communicate your needs. And I feel like this can go so against, you know, the common sort of idea that we have around like, or that society can have around BDSM, that it's like, you know, it's like a damaging thing, or it's about, you know, there might be undertones of abuse, or, you know, some sort of like, you know, there's something within you where you like want to be like punished in a certain way coming from a negative place. And what I love about your writing and what you share, Lena, is that you really, you know, talk to the healing aspects of BDSM and kink. Would you be able to share a little bit more about some of those misunderstandings and healing BDSM?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the core of those misunderstandings, I think, comes from sadism and masochism. I think that people have a really hard time understanding how pain can be something that's desired when they haven't had that physical experience. I read a really wonderful book by my friend Lee Cowart, who wrote this book called Hurts So Good, The Science and Culture of Pain on Purpose. And Lee draws a really great distinction between pain and aversive sensation. So that aversive sensation is something our bodies crave that feels good, that isn't what you think of as like a gentle stroke or a neck massage. Like, it could be spanking, paddling, electroplay, whatever. But if your body craves it and you're receiving it in a consensual container, that's different than like having a migraine, right? So kink recontextualizes things based on our desire for them. And so when we have that felt experience of the full consent of, I want to be spanked. Can you please spank me? Okay, you're spanking me. Okay, I can say no whenever I want to stop it. Having that consensual container to experience things that are taboo, that you're afraid to want, shows you a degree of consent and agency that I think many other experiences can't give you, that physical, somatic, felt experience of control. For me, heteronormative sexual scripts felt very objectifying when I look back on them now. Like the assumption that sex is going to flow in a very specific way without us ever talking about it. Like I had a one night stand with a guy one time where I, you know, it was like not a word was exchanged, but there was, you know, kissing, then oral, then penetration. And I was, I brought up spanking because that was my move back then. I was like, hey, what if you spank me? Which nowadays I wouldn't sign off on. And he was like horrified. But during the sex, choked me. So it was like, you know, the surprise, an unnegotiated choking, which is so dangerous. And so like, I was never consulted. And then at the moment that I brought up my own needs, it was like, whoa, don't be weird, you know? And I think that's a really common experience for people in those less codified sort of sexual situations. And then kink gave me this experience where you sit down with a partner and you completely disassemble sexuality and you say, okay, all of these things are equal. Which ones are okay with you and which ones aren't? And here are your words to call when you're not comfortable and not safe. And we know what we're going to do when that happens. And the problem with this, which is not really a problem, but in the short term causes a lot of problems, is that you look at the rest of your life and you're like, oh God, where am I not having these felt experiences of somatic safety in my work, with my family, with my friends? And I've talked to a lot of submissives who are like, oh my gosh, I've been giving this submissive energy away inappropriately in all these other areas. And now that I have this felt experience of consent, I can't live with that anymore. So that's where the healing comes in, I think, for a lot of people with kink, whether whatever role you're in.
That is fascinating, because I wonder at what point was your kink kind of emerging in alignment with also your Christianity as well? Like, was there a sense that you had this almost submission to God and you replaced that with a kind of a realignment of where you wanted to place a submission within your own personal experience and expression of sexuality?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that what happened to me as a teenager was very coercive. I was not raised Christian, but I was brought into, like, recruited into an evangelical culture where we were doing lock-ins and, like, not eating. And, like, these are all things that cults use to manipulate young people and people of any age. And the sense of belonging. And I think that purity cultures give young people a really great way of contextualizing complicated feelings that are emerging. Like, okay, abstinence. Like, here's how you handle boys. Here's how you handle this. This is what boys are thinking. Like, all of that really appealed to me because I think I felt the tsunami of horniness that was going to sort of rule my life coming on board. And I was like, I don't know what to do. Somebody tell me what to do. And so that all was easier for me to accept than to be in charge of it myself. So in that way, yeah, there was an alleviation of having to make decisions, but it was not in the same consented way that I now experience it with my Dom, because you're only alleviated of the ability to make decisions after you've made a lot of personal decisions about how to do that when you're in Dom sub. But at the same time, I think a lot of people experience spirituality through kink. Like, it can take you to transcendent spaces. It can take you to, you know, subspace is something that people can experience just from the act of exchanging power this way. And in the same way that religion can be perverted to control and harm people, those feelings in kink and BDSM can absolutely also be perverted to control and harm people because we're all human beings. But we do have these guardrails and language around it to try to prevent that, and community support so people can, you know, sound off each other and see what's going on and if it works. Whereas in Christianity, it's like, you know, don't talk about it because then you're going to hell. There's like no ability to question or talk about things, which also adds the coercion. Yeah, there's it's interesting. There's parallels, and yet all of the context makes it so different.
And engaging with partners and, you know, finding people who are just, you know, really on the same page as far as, you know, how safe they are. And, you know, for me, it's like if I'm to connect with somebody who is more dominant, or when Liam and I are connecting, it's like somebody who is at their core, you know, who actually like is a feminist, who really is caring about my needs, who is really just across all of those things, to hold that safe container to be able to go, you know, into subspace. I remember the first time that I entered into subspace, just hearing you share about it being a spiritual experience. It really was so interesting for me because it felt like all time had stopped, and it was so deeply cathartic. It actually overwhelmed me. It's like I didn't know if it had been, you know, half an hour or if hours had passed. But what I knew was that I felt so incredibly safe in the situation, you know, that I was in. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit about subspace and you know, what that can look like for different people or for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Subspace shows up really differently for different people. And I think the best way that it can be described to somebody who hasn't experienced it is an endorphin rush. So when for runners, for example, we'll experience this runner's high, or there's like a yoga high. It's this sort of combined experience of sort of, I think, having sort of a purpose and using your body in a very specific way. And endorphins are, and so often subspace is sort of equated to something that you might feel when you're doing masochism. Another great thing from Lee Cowart's book is that I learned that is that the word endorphin is a portmanteau of endogenous morphine. So it's morphine that your body creates to address pain, and morphine gets you high. So there is sort of a feeling of getting high on your own supply of your own hormones and body, and sort of tweaking these dials of adrenaline and endorphins. And so that experience, everyone reacts to it differently, right? Like everyone reacts to alcohol differently. Everyone reacts to tequila differently. And so everyone is going to react to this blend of your own body's endogenous fun stuff in a different way. So I think that the sort of generalized accepted version of subspace most people know is like feeling floaty or quiet or sort of, yeah, space cadet energy. And that's why nonverbal safe words can be really helpful, not to get into a whole different thing, but being able to communicate in different ways depending on where that subspace takes you is really important. What I've seen a lot in other subs, because my Dom and I, we play with other subs in threesome scenes, is giggles. Like I know a lot of subs who just get uncontrollable giggles, which from the outside, you'd be like, you're getting paddled with a huge wooden paddle. Why are you laughing about it? You can't explain it. My Dom has a really special talent for like the long pause before hitting you again and not knowing which one he's going to. And he'll do this also with electroplay. Like we have this toy called the Tzapper, and it's so loud and scary and you don't know where he's going to be in the room or when he's going to get you. And the giggles are just out of control, even though it hurts and it's scary, but it's this consented, fun nervousness. Also, people will sometimes cry cathartically, and that's another time to negotiate safe words. Like, is crying a safe word? Or if I'm crying, does that mean I want to go deeper and harder and I want that cathartic experience? And so we've negotiated that I can cry and it doesn't mean stop. It means keep going so I can move through that feeling. And yeah, so subspace shows up in a lot of different ways. It's all about, you know, it's almost like talking about psychedelics, like set and setting of, you know, how do you come in? What's the environment you're in? And then like throwing these things into the mix to see how it all plays out.
Do you remember the first time in a scene where you went into subspace?
Yes, I remember my first scene with my Dom. I think I may have experienced it before that, but there was just this sense of like, it's hard. It's like a layer of irony and self-consciousness was removed from my experience of sex, if that makes sense. Like, I wasn't like, oh, am I being cool? Am I doing the right thing? Like that whole secondary narrative voice was gone. And I was just such putty in his hands that I didn't really need to consider any of that. I just sort of had this feeling that I was doing everything right. I've never said this out loud before, but for some reason, I want to tell you guys it was like so, it's so embarrassing, but so cute and really describes like the mindset. The Game of Thrones was on at the time, and I remembered that scene between Daenerys and Khal Drogo when they first had sex, and the her like Handmaiden was like, love comes in at the eyes, Khaleesi. And I like had such deep feelings for him that I was like looking with my little doe eyes like at him, because I was like just this little ball of putty. And I was like, this was not like my MO in any way. I was very like callous bad girl and kind of like mean during sex with in vanilla situations, but then in this situation I'm like limp, chained up, like staring with my huge doe eyes, and I was like, okay, this is different. Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. I mean, it's interesting because it feels like in a way, Subspace, it kind of removes that performative aspect from sex. Like we were talking before about those heteronormative scripts where it's like, okay, we go down on each other and then we have the sex and then everything is kind of following along in this particular order. But as soon as you're entering into Subspace, did you feel that kind of complete alleviation of just being able to completely relax and just accept, the situation?
Exactly that. Yeah. And I think I want to explain further why that heteronormative script feels objectifying to me is that it has no investment in my individual preferences. Like, what if I don't want to do one of these things along the cycle? What if I don't want to know what's happening next? What if I don't want to be equally responsible for making a move silently without describing what's going to happen? Like, I think so many aspects of kink bring you into the present moment in a really special way, and Subspace as well. But also on the flip side, Topspace is something that people experience directing scenes as well. So my Dom, he's also described feeling so empowered and embodied and in the moment. And the aspect of taking control for him is the way to also sidestep that sort of rote, repetitive, heteronormative thing. It's like anything could happen, but anything within the safe space that we've negotiated together.
So Lena, you know, you're an incredibly, progressive person and you're a very empowered person. I'm really interested to know, the sort of balance between, being a feminist, in the real world and then, going against, in our own personal lives. You know, for me personally, I think about this as well, sort of playing into some of these roles, as a woman, being submissive and, worshipping a man and all of these things, which can be so against, the current dialogue of like what a feminist is or, how we should be in the world, and the sort of balance of like, who we are, out in our day jobs, out in that life or as parents or, just people in society, and then the balance between that and like actually, connecting in with other aspects of ourself that are in a little bit contradiction to how we would be out in public.
No, it's totally a thing. And when I first started making memes on Instagram around 2018, I would say 2019, there was so much discourse about this going on. And every comment section I had, it was like, how can you be a feminist and do this? Blah, 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 blah. But the thing about that is that, well, we could talk about this for 10 hours. That's the problem with bringing in broader social themes. But the problem with that is that it assumes power to look one very specific and external way, that it expects power to look like, standing in a wide stance with your hands on your hips telling somebody what to do. And that is one form of power, and that's one form of power that some people exercise. But there's sort of this paradox when talking about feminism and kink where it's like, well, I choose to submit, and so that's my choice, and anything that is my choice is feminist. And that choice-based feminism is something that a lot of people have talked about for a long time and criticized rightly, because maybe not all choices are empowering or feminist choices. But in this case, the ability to give up some of my executive functioning and give it to somebody else is what recharges me to go back into the real world and to have that power. It gives me a felt experience of consent that gives me a vision for community building that we need in feminism. I think that the exclusive focus on choice and being empowered and like being in a suit is like very lean in Sheryl Sandberg white feminism about increasing marginal levels of power. But when we talk about a feminism that's intersectional, I think it's so much more important for us to have these felt experiences of consent, boundaries, lateral community building, recharging ourselves with self-care so that we can show up in the world in these ways. So feminism doesn't apply to submission when we're talking about these sort of marginal increases of power for white women. But when we talk about it as a space where we negotiate power, understand what non-consensual power feels like, then we can go in and critique the patriarchy and the way that it non-consensually dominates all of us in a way that none of us ever chose, and it was here long before we were born. So that's where I've landed on the feminist milieu these days. I totally respect people's feeling that, like, if you're getting spanked, you can't be a feminist. I just sort of feel like that's off topic. Like, I think that my self-care is my own, and that's what I get to do. And whether people think it's feminist is their own thing to reckon with, that I totally respect. But yeah, that's where I've landed.
Yeah, that's amazing. Really connect with that, especially with this being, you know, it's like, this is self-care. Like, we're doing this because it's, you know, it is healing. It is amazing. I know for me, you know, as a mother, it's like there can be so many things that I'm thinking about, or, you know, my work and just my day-to-day life. And to be able to have moments where I can slip away and actually, like, have, you know, I don't need to have decisions being made for me, and I can just have, you know, go into that space. It's like so incredibly rewarding and amazing.
Yeah. And you deserve to have your cup filled up in order to be a mother in a world where motherhood is so devalued at the same time that women are devalued. And then you're in this intersection of, I don't know if it's better in Australia, but in America, like, mothers are the ones, or, and, you know, parents are the ones on the front lines of all of the ways that society has failed us. So if I'm going to go into a, you know, parent teacher association meeting with a sense of appropriate boundaries for on behalf of my child, I think that there is this sort of consent framework that can map onto parenting. And where else are you supposed to have that physical nonverbal experience with it than in sexuality, which is a place where we get to practice it a lot?
I find, as a man operating in the world of kind of BDSM and kind of experimenting and through our experimentations, some of the men that I've met who would consider themselves kind of DOMs, they are the most feminist men that I've met personally.
Yes.
You know, they're the ones who are so interested and invested in the experience of women and ensuring that, you know, there is that always that sense of consent within sexual situations, but also within the broader scheme. Is that something that you found as well with the different men that you've come across within the BDSM scene?
1,000%. I think that male DOMs, and we have friends in person and I have people in my Discord community, show me how masculinity can transcend the fragility that has defined it for so long. Like, there's nothing sexier in the world than a man who can listen to you complain about patriarchy without feeling like he's being personally attacked. And my DOM fit that criteria. It was something I would bring up on a first date, and he'd be like, yeah, it's fucked. Like, it's really hard for women. Like, I believe you that you don't feel comfortable walking alone at night. And, like, just these basic concessions to not be in a constant war of trying to be seen, I think are fundamental to BDSM. I don't think BDSM can be done unless the person topping understands how power impacts the various identities you hold. Like, at the same time as I bring in my female identity to my relationship, if there were a relationship between a white person and a person of color, that white person needs to be working to dismantle their white fragility to show up for the reality of power in that relationship. So DOMs do get this opportunity to have this felt experience of the intersection of identity in the relationship, and just to continually be negotiating with that and not taking it personally is such an amazing exercise. And it's just like that sexual exercise for boundaries. It's like the kink brings you this repeated homework of interrogating your space in the world as a person. So DOMs do end up being those people that are like, yeah, feminism, whatever, not threatened by it, sounds good, you know. Which is rare among certain men.
Yeah, absolutely. But so important that people, so important that men start embracing these ideals. And in sex positive communities, there is just so many incredible men that I've met that have dismantled that kind of sense of the tropes of masculinity, these like stoic men who are just like aggressive and in all the wrong ways. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's such a, we did a really interesting thing with my Discord community where we had men in the community send me voice memos about how dominance intersects with mindful masculinity for them. And it was so eye-opening to see how so many men grew up with such an impoverished version of masculinity to aspire to. Mm. They had fathers who were violent or not emotional, or who portrayed manhood as something about being tough and being emotionless. And dominance can come in for certain men and provide them, if they're willing to be open to what it actually means, not just exerting power over somebody, but to be in that sort of interrogation, it provides them a path towards masculinity that is celebrated, because we have a rightful, great conversation going on right now about toxic masculinity and everything that can be going wrong with masculinity. But there are parts of it that are beautiful. And when they're enabled in a consensual way, men can integrate this thing that, A, maybe they were never taught how to do it in a mindful way. And then B, they're being feel demonized and attacked for what not to do. So it's like, well, what is the path forward? And men who find their way into BDSM can find that path forward in a really beautiful way. And I think integrate that like patriarch energy without it being the patriarchy, you know?
Yes. Yeah, well, it goes back to what you were saying before about the healing nature of BDSM and, you know, just how healing it can be.
Across the board.
Yeah. And but saying that, and how I've met so many great men, I also have witnessed this appearance of this fake dom energy. And Abby often gets hit up on different things, being like, oh, you know, like men who have almost co-opted BDSM just for their own nefarious means to go, okay, I'm going to say that I'm a dom. I'm going to say that I'm really into dominance and spanking, but really have absolutely no idea about what that actually is.
Or just straight up, hey, baby girl, in the DMs.
Yeah.
And you share about this often in your you know, on your Instagram. I remember years ago when I first came across it, that's how I found you, and I was like, that's me, that's what's happening to me. Hey, baby girl in the DMs, these fake doms.
It's exhausting. Yeah, there are certainly people who I like to say that if you watch porn in order to learn how to have sex, it's like watching The Fast and the Furious to learn how to drive. Like, it's not reality. It's a fictional situation. So I think a lot of men, unfortunately, have taken in from certain types of mainstream pornography that, like, you can just do stuff to people and you don't have to do any of this internal work, because the negotiation and safety parameters of those porn scenes were developed off camera and they're not included in the editing. Like, those scenes take days to shoot. They stop down in the middle. They break for water. There's, in many cases nowadays, is getting better with aftercare. So these men are taking the fictional version and trying to apply it to reality, and that's just like straight up dangerous. So it's very sad to see that happening, because it's like, oh, you're so close to getting the medicine that you really need for the way you're behaving in the world, but instead you're just accidentally stumbling into looking foolish, I think, mostly. But the real danger with that behavior, the hey baby girl on an app, is when subs and I think women who sleep with men are in a particularly disadvantaged situation in the BDSM community, because they may not have the same support as queer folks might get from their peers about this stuff. They might be alienated. They might be, again, laboring under that thing of, oh, it's not feminist, so I can't talk about it. So these layers of shame and alienation strike these women particularly hard. And then some guy comes in and it's like, hey, baby girl, and they feel nervous, like, oh my gosh, well, he thinks he's a dom. Maybe this is how the community is, and my discomfort is just me being new, and I have no one to ask. So better just go down this road. And that happens to so many people because they're afraid of looking stupid by going with their intuition. And that's the real danger with these fake dom people, is making people think this is how it is, when in reality they're just dum-dums.
Yeah, and it really speaks to the importance of open conversation about these things and platforms like yours, where there is this educational resource. So even if people don't feel comfortable going to their friends, hey, this guy messaged me and there's already this dynamic, is this weird? Like, he's saying a few things that could be potential red flags, that they, even in the privacy of their own home, they can turn to an online community and say, hey guys, like, this guy just suggested, like, turning up in a park and he's going to shibari. We're going to do a shibari scene on a park bench, and I've never met him before. And then all the friends are just like, this is insane behavior.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, and we often are talking with kind of friends who aren't in sex positive communities, and they mm-hmm. will say, they'll either have red flags that just aren't red flags, or they'll have red yeah. flags, or they won't see the red flags that are actually the mm-hmm. biggest red flags of all.
Well, when you're wearing rose-colored glasses, red flags just look like flags. But we have a great channel on my I just keep mentioning my Discord server because I'm just so impressed by these people. But we have a great channel called Red Flag Screenshots, where people bring stuff from dating apps where they remove the information and they go, is this normal? And then people will be like, no, it's crazy. So like, that's really helpful. But then in other times, people will challenge it with good faith reads of these things and say, like, I don't know if this is fully red flag yet. Maybe ask this follow-up question. I think a really good question to test someone who's seeming like a fake dom that I've given people a lot is to ask them what their limits are, because when someone who's posturing as a dom is confronted with the idea that they might be vulnerable, they're like, no, I don't have any limits. I could do anything. I'm a big, strong, you know, invulnerable superhero. But then when you ask that of a real dom, they'll be like, oh, this, that, and the other thing don't work for me, or I'm not comfortable with this, or what are your limits? You know, it's just a question that isn't threatening to their ego. But that's a really good hack to get in at those like fake doms. Another thing that I have to mention is that I feel like the concept of fake dom can sometimes be simplified to this really like obviously incorrect thing. But this form of abuse, I think, is getting more and more insidious with like sex positive culture being co-opted by certain men. Sorry, men, not all of you, but, you know, some. There was a really great piece about when the Army Hammer thing happened, where do you guys know Army Hammer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to like briefly summarize, he was this actor who was initiating really askew kink dynamics with people introducing like a cannibalism fetish without anyone consenting to it and making people feel really unsafe and scared. And then the whole conversation had this weird thing of like, well, should we be kink shaming him? Maybe we shouldn't be kink shaming him. We're all sex positive. This is his kink. It's not about whether you have a kink. Like, being sex positive is one thing, but being accepting of bad behavior is a totally different thing. So thankfully, we're starting to dismantle that a little better. But if somebody's like, my right to make you uncomfortable, if you're not okay with that, that's kink shame. That's very bad. That's suspicious. And that's definitely like a precursor to a whole cyclone of abuse that could happen, of just like twisting concepts in order to make you feel unstable and question yourself and be gaslit. So that's another thing that the people are doing. Gotta love it.
It does also bring up the importance of communities also checking in on each other and also challenging some of the things. Like, as you were saying, if people in good faith are going, actually, I don't know, there might be some gray area here. Because often what I've seen in some communities, and we were members, I'm thinking of one particular community in New York, which I won't name, that we're members, but it was an online community, and it eventually got co-opted in a way where it became almost this confirmation bias, where a lot of people were stacking on, and sometimes in a way that was unfair to the people involved. And it felt like once the tide had turned and the public perception of someone had turned, there was really no space for a kind of logical discussion in which all the gray areas can actually be nutted out. And sometimes these things are totally warranted, and people are just, you know, there's bad people in all communities, and those people absolutely deserve to be found out and held accountable. But there is a way in which sometimes online communities can kind of form this mob mentality where they just kind of see something and then go for something. So it's great that as you were saying, within your Discord community, that some people feel comfortable to challenge some of those conversations.
Yeah, and that's something that's been really disappointing in our sex positive communities, where we sort of infantilize adults in relationships and everything gets called abuse. Like, conflict and abuse are completely different concepts. And when we're talking about being on the lookout for like nefarious villains using the apps to behave very clearly badly, that's one thing. But then two adults not being right for each other and choosing to disengage is a really different thing. And I think that we definitely have a disease of this like circular firing squad of just like everybody's wrong, everybody's an abuser. And that kind of mentality, I think, is really contrary to what we sign on for in kink, because we're signing on to be respected equals in charge of our own limits. And not every disagreement or mismatch means that somebody is a villain. It means that we're human beings who are figuring out relationships. So that's, again, it's like it lives in so many gray areas that it requires all of this additional self-reflection and work and community building that a lot of people in vanilla, you know, who've been conditioned to vanilla heteronormative sexuality and dating scripts just aren't used to doing all of that additional work. It is additional work, but then you get to play with the fun toys when you've done the additional work. So worth it.
Absolutely. And, you know, this talk of, you know, finding the right dom and a safe dom and a fake dom. I also have always felt that, you know, if we were to connect with a woman who is a submissive female, you know, like finding somebody who is like really aware of their own boundaries and their own limits and, you know, to connect with somebody who won't be breaking their own boundaries or feeling comfortable with something, you know, in the moment, but then later, you know, not feeling at peace with where they're at. And I think, you know, maybe I'm oversharing here, but I think for Liam and I, perhaps this is part of the reason why a lot of our own dynamics, you know, in this world have always sort of been between the two of us, because it's like, I'm so just, you know, I know,
hyper aware,
just hyper aware and just, you know, wanting it to be a completely, you know, safe space. And, you know, we haven't ever really been to a kink party or anything like that, but we're deeply kinky people. It's incredibly interesting.
Yeah. We felt that our expression of kink is safest, certainly with how we play with each other within like a more private setting. Because as I was saying before, that there is that risk as well of things being completely consensual in the moment, and then the reframing that could potentially happen afterwards, and then the perception of it, just because it's a BDSM thing, you know, people coming in and going, well, this is, you know, this is the worst example of this. This is clearly abuse. And then they use a word such as abuse in a way that really takes away the power of that word when it's used appropriately in appropriate situations. Because when real abuse is happening, it is so important to have the weight of that word.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But then when you're crying wolf with that word, The place that we're at, I think, in all sex positive communities right now is something that's been so conditioned by the panopticon of the internet and like the way that we cancel and talk about all of this stuff that it influences our own shame voice. Like the shame voice for me started out as like a Christianity shame voice, which is just like your, you know, Coca-Cola of shame voices, like, you know, people have it. But like the more bespoke and specific shame voice has evolved out of the way that people talk about this on the internet. And I feel exactly the same way about playing with other people. Like, are we going to, as adults, decide that this didn't work for us? Or are we going to go to a place of like, you're this and I'm this and black and white and like, this conflict, you know, or this mismatch means that, you know, it's abusive or coercive. And while we luckily haven't had any experiences that specific, there have certainly been feelings of like, is it unethical to break up? Like this question of ethics into sexuality is so confusing. I think it's like very like, you know, I have experiences in my past with relationships that have had gaslighting in them, both with my, you know, with former partners or my, you know, parents. Like, and there's this feeling when you're being gaslit and your sort of tether to reality is removed and you're floating in outer space and you're like, wait a second, is it like this? Did that happen that way? And I think that conversation about ethics with sexuality is exactly the same. Like, this thing is valid and this thing is unethical and those words don't mean anything to me. And so then trying to import them on like adults making choices for the purposes of pleasure, just like they don't map one to one. So these conversations are just like another way, I think, of shaming and controlling people, but we aren't ready to really talk about that because there's also positive things that attitude has brought for people. So it's a transitional moment for sure.
And when you're looking for a third, you mentioned that you often have female partners that you and your partner play with. You know, how do you see that? You know, there's so much discourse around couples privilege, and especially in non-monogamy, you know, this kind of concept of unicorn hunting. You know, how do you balance that? Because I'm sure you talk about this as much as Abby and I talk about this.
Yes. Yeah, we certainly talk about it. I think The concept of unicorn hunting is one that's interesting to me as a bisexual woman that's been on the apps. Like, I've certainly had that experience of couples who have never had a threesome and it's like his birthday and like she's like scared, you know, maybe going to be scared to touch me and like I'm just there and like my queerness, it would be, I never went through with any of these situations, but I would get approached and it would be like, I just, I smelled it that like my queerness would be erased by the experience. It would be, it would be a replay of the girls in college that kissed me at a party for male attention. Like that is what is being described by unicorn hunting. The conversation has gone too far when we talk about like couples should never be on the apps looking for a third. It's unethical. And it's like, okay, like there's a big difference between unethical and like people trying and failing to find what they want, which is exactly what single people are doing as well. I think that couples have a duty to interrogate themselves and to not use thirds in like an objectified way, to treat them as human beings. But then, you know, this is what you're not supposed to say. My husband and I in this process have absolutely been objectified coming the other way as well. Like people who are fresh onto the sex positive dating apps, they've been there for 24 hours. They're like ready to have a kooky experience with some weird kink people. And then it's like, we're out at a bar with that person. And it's like very clear that they're like going through something and we're like a prop that's part of that. We've gotten a lot better at not going forward with those kinds of people and not having a scarcity mindset about it. But like, there are ways where you can end up feeling like someone's experimental phase and not like a person. And in the same way,
is that unicorn privilege?
Oh my god, if I coin that, I'm gonna be canceled off the internet. But
Clementine will support us, it's all right.
Yes, thank you, Clementine. Yeah, no, it's really interesting. It's been also a process when relationships aren't working out, where like if feelings are involved, I had, you know, one particular experience that I wrote about for my Substack that was a long-term relationship with this girl where I had really deep feelings for her, and my feelings were very queer. It wasn't just like, I'm a married woman and you're an accessory to me and I don't care about you. It was like very deep. I was like sending her books and like writing her sweet texts, and like I thought about her a lot. There were big swoons, like big, you know, NRE. And then when it wasn't working for her anymore, it just was like, oh well, you guys are a couple, so like I don't really need to act with the kind of respect or consideration that you deserve because like you guys have each other. So it was like, well, you guys have each other, so like I don't need to take care of your feelings. And like the way that I feel that she behaved in the breakdown of that relationship would have been totally different if it was one-on-one. Maybe not, but I did get this sense that it's like you are invulnerable to pain because you're married to each other. And that just like doesn't track for me with like my queer understanding of what's happening in those situations. So like, yeah, there's pain on both sides, but then there can be this like immense privilege of being able to come together in that space. We had another relationship that lasted 6 years until she moved out of town. And we just had this ongoing, lovely, pleasant, friendly exchanging gifts on birthdays and Christmas and just like having wild, passionate, freaky sex, you know, here and there twice a month. And getting that experience as well of having like a really functional, caring thing without like all of the blow up of individual dating that can happen sometimes was really wonderful. So there's a real big spectrum of experience, and it just, I don't know, different maturity levels come to the table when you're playing with this. And yeah, there's a lot of ins and outs.
Gosh, I'm feeling so incredibly seen right now just hearing about you, you know, going through that breakup and feeling your pain, and it's sort of being like, well, you've already got someone, so you should be fine, you know.
Yeah,
I did go through a bit of a breakup a couple of years ago, and it was, you know, it was really hard to sort of you know, share about it with people. And you know, it was a little bit under wraps, but you know, there was that idea around it where it's like, I am a married woman, and so like I shouldn't be allowed to be feeling this grief that I'm feeling about, you know, something else falling apart. But I'm really interested, you know, we're sort of now talking a bit about like relationships and BDSM and these dynamics and sort of the intersection between like being a non-monogamous person and having dynamics and how they might sort of weigh in or impact each other. You know, Liam and I, we have really long-standing dynamics at play between us. You know, this is like 12-year long. dynamics. And it's just, it's really interesting because we are quite private about that aspect of our lives, but we are also in the non-monogamous space. I'd say we're somewhere on the spectrum between, you know, open, but also like do have more sort of polyamorous, you know, more meaningful, like romantic connections at different times, and just the balancing of that. And it's been an incredible, like an incredibly interesting journey. Mm-hmm. And actually, I want to share something, you know, and a number of many years ago, the first person that I ever dated outside of my relationship with Liam, we all were friends with this beautiful man. It was really fascinating because he and I had a bit of a dom sub thing happening where he was the dom and I was the sub, and that was so amazing. And Liam was in full support and like we were just having a great time. And he had another partner where he was submissive to her, and she wanted to meet me and to meet Liam and I, because they were, you know, in a polyamorous relationship. So we organized to go out on this double date, and it was so fascinating because before the date he said, look, I'm in like a 24/7 sub dynamic with her, you know, just wanted to let you know in case you see me like pulling out the chair and doing these different things, or like I might seem a little bit different. And I was like, oh, that's amazing, like that's great, like can't wait. And we went out for dinner, and I could see how deeply like conflicted he was, because he and I had this on, we had our dynamic, and then he was, you know, with her showing this other side. And do you remember that?
Yeah, he was carrying her bag, and like it was beautiful. And I was like, oh, good on you, mate. You know, as a Gemini myself, I'm thinking, oh, I guess it, you know, we've all got the duality within us, you know.
It's like I'm picturing the scene in Mrs. Doubtfire where he's like changing costumes, running back and forth to the table, like the wig is askew, like having to wear both roles like that is so intense.
Yeah, it was really fascinating, and it turned into a really interesting night, which is, you know, probably for another conversation. But, you know, I do remember the next day he messaged me and he said, look, you know, I think when we catch up again, you know, I think she might not come next time because like I don't know who I am. when we're all together.
So interesting the ways that kink and polyamory or non-monogamy can like collide and fit so well with each other, and then in certain ways be really at odds. Like the way that kinky people do non-monogamy can be different or can be exactly the same. But I feel sometimes when you talk about the discourse, that there's a discourse sometimes in the non-monogamy community that kitchen table poly is the only ethical choice and all other forms of hierarchical non-monogamy are completely wrong and screwed and, you know, but, and like, you know, for instance, for like thirds to couples, like there's this feeling of like you are lesser and you need to be the same. And it's like in kink, we can understand how people in negotiated specific roles can be happy in those roles. Like maybe those thirds don't want a live-in partner. Maybe, you know, in this way, I feel that in a way it's kind of toxic monogamy culture leeching into non-monogamy, because it's like, oh, well, like if it's not perfectly even kitchen table, then it's bad because you need to be at the topmost point of that relationship escalator in order to be a respected equal. But maybe that person doesn't want to cohabitate. Maybe they don't want all of these things. So like in kink, we have certain language around that, but then I think some of us can get really lost in the sauce of like, well, wait, is it allowed that I'm not like acting these out in a certain way? Is it allowed to keep things separate, or do we all need to go to dinner and someone needs to be Mrs. Doubtfiring it through that dinner, like trying to figure out who to be? Like, what if that separation is just consent? Like, you know, that's something that's really tripped me up. And I've gotten, certainly some internet outrage about like people talking about one penis policies, which is like, I heard that term first and someone didn't use it like in that way. They said like, what do you think of a male dom having multiple separate female subs and then those subs don't get to have other doms? And I was like, well, I guess if those subs, you know, as consenting adults want to do that, then they can do that. And I got like flamed, like you wouldn't believe within an inch of my life, of like, you are perpetuating toxic ideas. It's misogynistic. It's like letting these men be homophobic towards those women's queerness if they only want to be with women. Like, I'm sure the spectrum of issues you're very familiar with around that concept. So I was educated by that. But I also hold true to the idea that like, consent is a factor. So if these, you know, these hypothetical women are in that kind of situation where they feel empowered and that's all they need. I as an outside observer, can't take that away from those people. I wouldn't go around saying it's unethical and problematic for those people to want what they want during that era of their life. Mm. So like the conversations as the communities intersect can get really dizzy and confusing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that's a place where I've been like, why can't we just assume people are happy with the things that they choose? Mm. And, you know, is that something that you guys see?
Well, I mean, it strips agency away from people. And this is something that we've seen with some of these, some of the discourse and a few very prominent, not that I'll mention the names, kind of Instagram accounts and different things where it's almost like they're gravitating towards a set of rules so they can have this in-group and out-group. Like, you are unethical and we are the ethical ones. Maybe you should follow us. And I wonder whether there is like, it's like a byproduct of that kind of religiosity and the sense of people really kind of striving, like feeling comfortable with a set of rules and going, okay, everything's got to be non-hierarchical. Everyone, you know, I've seen things like, you know, like you should be sharing bank accounts with all your partners. And if you don't share bank accounts, then you are unethical. And then all these like thousands of comments just being like, yeah, this is how it should be done. And I'm thinking, like, come on, guys. Like, do we really need to take it to these levels?
I saw a TikTok a while back that I first saw it and I felt so attacked by it and like upset. And then I realized that it was bonkers, which is like, it was like this very cool looking like Bushwick, you know, thruple. And it was one woman and two men. And the whole video was like, this is the only ethical form of thruple because she's getting I can't even do the math of what they were trying to say, but they were basically like, if this woman has two men, that's better than one man having two women because of like gender equity reasons. And I was like, wait a second. So we're saying that like men are more valuable than women. And if you have more of them, like, how does that pan out to be like equal in any way? So I like sent this to my friend who is very queer and doing total kitchen table non-monogamy where all of the partner metamors are friends and there's children that are cared for and like it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And she was like, this is fucking bullshit. Like, so somebody doing in my mind like that like ethical version that it is being espoused on Instagram is like, this is fucking bullshit. Everyone just do what you want. My husband and I have a phrase that's very helpful for these things. It's like, again, is it cancelable? I don't know. But like, we'll look at stuff and we'll be like, this doesn't fuck. You know what I mean? Like, it's like you're talking about like, oh, it's only like this, that, and the other. If we parse it down to like the bank accounts, and it's like people who are out here fucking aren't concerned with this or like concerned with the specifics of our own lives. So it's all so hypothetical that by the time people even step their toe in, they're like, oh my God, should I share my routing number on a first date? It's like, no, there's just an internet economy of telling people what to do that doesn't make any sense.
Totally. And way to just strip the eroticism just completely out of everything by like being in this hyper-vigilant, totally policed, rule-based, you know, way of relating. It's like, it's completely overwhelming. And it's like, it just makes sense to me. It's like, we can't have blanket rules on what consent is for everybody or what is ethical for everybody. Like, it's like, isn't the beauty of this that we can like craft our own situation with people, like where we're at within our needs and where they're at with their needs, and like create something totally unique? Like, isn't that the point? You know, or else it's just like, you know, there are the rules of monogamy, but it's like, well, now we're in a whole different game with like a million more rules, and it's like totally stressed.
Yes. And everyone's hypervigilance actually shrinks the conversation because people don't feel safe to have conversation about really important topics. And we've had people, Abby's had people reach out on her Instagram just being like, I'm too scared like to even explore some of these concepts because I feel like if I'm not doing it a certain way, then obviously I can't do it. And you must think about this, Lena, with your platform. Because it is such a big platform and you do have such a big community, you have you do have a lot of influence and you are shaping the conversation in a lot of ways around how people think about kink. And the fact that you're so level-headed and reasonable is a beautiful thing. And I'm sure a large part of why people gravitate towards you. But is that something that you think about, of the responsibility that you have to the conversation?
I have I think about it a lot, and that's why I'm always trying to take in the internet discourse so that I know what people are coming to me with. And I just find that being somewhat boring is the only way to be reasonable about this. Like, I can't legislate with my hot takes exactly what everyone is supposed to be doing all the time, but that outrage culture is what keeps certain influencers in business, but that flames out. So, like, all you can do is equip adults with tools and treat them like adults and say, like, here's what you might be able to do in the gray area of the situation. And, like, in ways, that's more boring than, like, a peppy Canva infographic about shared bank accounts or whatever. Like, there's sort of a frustration with this space of, like, repetition, I think. Yeah.
And you bring such humor to it as well.
It's important to bring humor. I always think of this theater professor I had in college where he, like, broke down the different types of laughter that people experience in a live show. And I don't remember all of them, but there was one that's like the laugh of recognition, that we laugh even if something isn't funny because we understand it and we feel seen by it. And, like, that's a lot of what the meme game has been for me, is to be like, you have a shared experience with other people and you're seeing that, like, on a platform with such and such many followers and a picture of Mean Girls. Like, it's something that you can relate to and see yourself in, and then you can understand that you're not alone. So it's just that repetition of that, again, like, felt experience of not being alone. And the humor really, like, drills down on that and also gives us some levity to cut through the sanctimoniousness that can happen around this stuff, because everyone, I think, is paralyzed by this feeling that there's no way to do it right because of that nonsensical mapping of ethics onto sexuality and adult relationships. So it's like, if you can have your little jester's privilege of making fun of these things, then we can have more honest conversations about them than to be like, do my own very somber Canva post about, like, actually your thing is wrong, you know, like, just to be silly about it really helps.
So with the Ask a Sub community and your Patreon and your Discord and your Substack, there's obviously a huge community there who really relish and love the opportunity to connect in with each other. Do you find a kind of a draw or a pull to kind of having, like, an Ask a Sub conference, you know, where you book out a hotel and all these legends from all around the world kind of come together in this glorious meeting of like minds?
It's something I dream about. And since we're being so honest, like, my fear is that, like, that space wouldn't be an ethical perfect space, because human beings mess up and, like, things happen. And, like, I'll get, like, 95% of the way into a dream about doing, like, a retreat in Joshua Tree and, like, people all come together. And then I'm like, what if I can't control the behavior of the individual people involved in this? And what if something bad happens? I have anxiety. I have an anxiety disorder. So, like, I can really get into, like, the scrupulousness of how things may not be perfect. However, I did have my first in-person event last year with a collective here in LA that does figure drawing. I collaborated with them to have, like, a no phones, mostly undressed figure drawing of a model in Shibari. And, like, all of us collaborated on bringing this space together. And people were so enlivened by it and so kind to me and to each other. And there were wonderful connections made. And we had an experience where someone's stalker showed up at that event and, like, had bought a ticket. And there was nothing that any of us as organizers could have done, because that person's using shady fake email addresses. Like, so there's this imperfection that is inherent to the real world. Not that online is perfect, but I feel like this measure of control that, like, maybe this is, like, something I should say for therapy, but it's, like, something complicated that I think about, of, like, the joy of in person and then the messiness that doesn't jibe with the way that we talk about all of this stuff. And I very much see a way going forward someday of inhabiting a human body and face in the world and, like, having an identity. It's something that I crave, but, like, the right moment has not come yet for me, and all of that, because at the same time as it was wonderful to connect with people who are, like, like-minded and fans of the work and all of that, I also get really angry comments from dudes who have, like, yay Second Amendment in their Instagram bios, and I'm like, you know, like, there's a lot of fierce, and it's a big mix. But yeah, I do dream about a utopic Ask a Sub, like, pink branded you know, big cuddle puddle at a conference. That would be great.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, you know, safety and privacy is so important. This is something that Liam and I have spoken a lot about. We host in-person conversation evenings. They're not large. They're for about 20 people or so once a mm-hmm. month in Canberra and in Sydney on the topics of, you know, non-monogamy, polyamory, sort of more in that mm-hmm. space. We do touch a little bit on BDSM and kink themes, but mostly in the non-monogamous space. We often have people saying to us, you know, organize something bigger, or, you know, we feel like you guys hold such a great space. Would you ever consider mm-hmm. holding like a, you know, a sex party or some kind of big event that, you know, incorporates these things? And, you know, for the exact same reasons that you've just mentioned, I'm like, it's just the thought of doing that is so incredibly, you know, stressful, because it's like mm-hmm. no matter how well-intentioned, you know, we are, and no yeah. matter what happens with the space that is, you know, provided for, you know, for the people, it's like you still can never really control what happens. You know, you can put yeah. you can put everything in alignment, but it's still just, there are so many unknowables, you know.
And we vet stuff. Everyone mm-hmm. with our conversation nights, we vet everyone. They have to send us a video where they talk about why they want to come to the conversation night, which I mean, you know, AI is increasing in its power. So, you know, potentially there might be a world where that becomes difficult as well. But at the moment, you know, mm-hmm. it's actually allowed us to really properly vet. And as soon as you start to do things on scale, and this is the beauty of the internet and online communities, is that you can mm-hmm. do things on scale and still have that anonymity. So do you feel mm-hmm. with your anonymity, it's almost like part of the, I feel like it's part of the draw and the allure. Like, I've certainly felt that, you know, engaging with, I'm like, oh, I wonder what she looks like, you know? And it's, there is that kind of real mystique, that kind of intrigue. Do you play with that? Like,
yes, definitely something. As a Scorpio rising, I feel the need to infuse some mystery into things. But I have to ask you, because you're like looking at me right now, even though it'll be edited out for viewers, like what you expected? Different? Like, what did you picture? Gosh. Like, I can't relate to the experience of like not knowing what I look like.
I felt like you would definitely be brunette. So I picked that. I was like, her voice just feels, it feels like a brunette vibe.
Yeah,
you know?
Brunette voice.
And you're absolutely beautiful. I actually, like, when you said that you were going to turn your camera on, I actually had butterflies.
Yes,
I was so excited, because we'd spent, you know, late last night and this morning, I was like, do you think she'll be camera on or off? And Liam was like, definitely camera off. And I was like, I don't know, you know, I think she might ask once she knows that we're not going to, you know, put your video on the internet or any photos of you. Mm-hmm. You know, you might share your video. And gosh, it's just amazing.
I mean, you have a really attractive voice as well. So, you know, not to go too far into it, but it's like I definitely, like, there's no way that your voice wasn't going to be connected to you. Like, there was going to be a correlation.
Yeah. Thank you. I had a friend in high school whose her father was Brazilian, and he had this like amazing like sensual vibe, and he was like, your voice, it sounds like chocolate being poured all over my head. And I was like, thank you. Now I use my voice for my work, and I guess the people are feeling the brunette
have you ever done any ASMR, like
that
a special,
is something
like
I should do. Yeah, I should really think about that. It's I got the mic.
Subscriber,
you know,
over here.
Look.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe there's a vested interest, but I feel like the, you know, like a podcast episode of like you just like even just reading your writing, I feel like something like that would be such a vibe.
These are, you know, these are, sure, pitches these that we will put the on the calendar. No, you always need more. Yeah. Yeah, it's a really fun thing to not have a face. And then at the same time, I'm like, oh, I'd like to run into people who like know, and we could talk about it like out in LA. So I imagine one day like transcending that, but like using the vibe for like a really good reason. But yeah, the reason just has not yet.
I was just going to say, when you're dating, do you, I presume you don't tell people who you are?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, that has actually happened, where we went on a date with someone and we chit-chatted the whole time, and I used my legal name and I didn't reveal anything about my work, because it just puts me in a weird situation if like somebody knows the work before knowing me, and there's like projections, and then it sort of like puts the power off kilter, because like I'm not the dom, I just want to like let him lead, but then there's like a focus on me, so it's a very complicated thing. And I'm like, Yeah, so we have had an experience where somebody came away from the date and texted my dom and was like, I know her voice and I know who she is. And like, we should talk about that before we get into anything further. And there's like an issue for me of being perceived as like the internet sub that has everything like figured out. But my real identity as a sub plays out in like a less like loud and brassy way than I might be on my Substack. Like, I want like the quietness, and I have insecurities, and I have a human body, and like all of that playing into somebody having a pre-existing relationship with my work tends to really stress me out. So that's like, I really appreciate, it's frustrating because like, if somebody's new to BDSM, that can be helpful in like them not knowing who I am. But then there's the problem with like being new. So yeah, it has been a really wild and strange ride to negotiate all of that as the account has grown and like the podcast and all of it. It's very odd. Do you guys experience that dating? Are people familiar with the pod and your work?
Well, we did actually ask the same question to Jessica Fern, because we were fascinated. We were like you've written like the Bible on polyamory, and you know, like and
you're the author of Polysecure.
Like, you're the author of Polysecure. Like, what do you do? And she has these similar struggles, like being a public figure within these spaces and having a voice within the communities. And I think that's something that Abby is increasingly finding, is that you know, people, and because we're kind of public with our faces out.
Initially, I started with my writing. I wasn't face out. And then I think that came out maybe 2 years ago. We started, you know, sharing that. But I mean, we have gone a little bit more public, you know, with things. We've been on national TV. We've been on some really big podcasts. We've had a little doco made about us. And so, you know, we have stepped more into that public space. And yeah, it is really interesting. And it definitely, I think it does sort of impact my dating a little bit. And it impacts my openness to like really sort of sometimes connect in with people now. I do tend to feel more comfortable with people who I've known before becoming more, you know, public in this space. You know, even like lovers or connections that I had from when we were living in New York, like we've still have, you know, we still message, we still have that connection, because I feel like they've sort of connected in with me before that. As we're now, there can be that thing where I would know, you know, sometimes if I'm going on a date with somebody, you know, you know, I know when they know everything, you know, because they've listened to the episodes, or they'll start referencing things, or they'll be like, oh, because you're really so into something, or like Liam, and like, you know, sometimes it's like fine, but the other times it's a bit like, oh, like, you know, where's my mystery, or, you know, I even sort
like
of my
revealing.
Revealing or like my thoughts on something, like, you know, we've been podcasting, I think, now for nearly 2 years, I think. So it's like something that I might have said in an earlier episode isn't really like how I, you know,
also,
what
I think
now. We can't
remember that.
We can't remember. I don't know what I said.
Like, some people know us better than we know ourselves. And I'm thinking, what's going on here?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I have that. There's a split there where it's like, I have a moment, you know, in a scene where like things have like progressed and, you know, I'm getting spanked and I might call yellow sooner than that person was expecting because my pain tolerance isn't, perfectly high that day. And I'm like, oh my God, they're going to think I'm less, you know, which they probably aren't. But then there's like a moment where it's like, oh God, these are the sounds that Lena Dune makes while she's getting railed from behind. And I'm like, I don't know if I want people to know this stuff who have an association, but I am so proud of my work and I want to share it with people who get to know me as me first. And then, but then also it's like, oh gosh, like if things aren't working out, what will that person feel about the rejection of like of a breakup? Like, that adds so much pressure on me in that way. So it's like, there's just, there's been complications, I think, and sort of a grief in a way of losing that anonymity of just being a person and then having to like carry all of the work into these connections can be really surreal and weird, but grateful for it at the same time. It's, it's a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I'm at a point too where it's like entering into connections with people. Like, one of the things I really look for is, you know, that we will be able to peacefully part ways if and when the time comes, while still having respect for each other and respect that it is okay to break up. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we sort of jump on each other, you know, especially like what we were sharing about before, you know, with the discourse around, you know, things being reframed and all of that. So I am just like, I think it's made me just, it, you know, being a bit more public too. It's just put my guard up a little bit more. It just takes me a little bit longer to sort of open up.
And I think it's important to kind of go gradually into these things. Like the reveal is such a big thing. And Lena, once you do the reveal, everyone's going to be like, oh my God, this is what, you know, it's going to be like the whole thing is that, that there's such power in it, and it will, because you've already built the community around yourself, there will be that, the, you know, that, that added weight that comes with that as well. And it's not something that you can redact.
No, it's not. And yeah, I'm a writer at heart. Like, I never set out to be like a personality, and it's all like very surprising to me. Like, I feel like I have the brain and heart of like a, you know, behind the man behind the curtain kind of energy. And then to be like, oh no, it's like me and my voice and all of this. My Dom, he has no problem with this while dating. He's like, oh, you know her work? She's great. I'm proud of her. Let's all fuck. Like, he just doesn't experience like any of the issues, because he's like, yeah, like, I'm the Dom. Like, I've supported her. We've created this together. Like, let's fucking go. And I have like so many more thoughts and feelings about it than he does, which it's helpful. It's helpful to have him in that way. But yeah, it's very odd.
Well, I mean, he would feel such pride over, you know, what you do, and he would want to kind of boast in a way, you know, and I feel like that with Abby, you know, like I'm kind of thinking, like, it's kind of weird when, like, one guy listened to like all of the episodes before going on a date with Abby. And in a way I was like, that's obviously weird. And the date is weirder because of that, I would say. But I'm also like, yeah, you should. Like, they're awesome. Yeah. Like, it's great. Like, read all her writing. Like, she's awesome. My wife's awesome. Like, check her out. But then also don't check her out too much, you know, because it's kind of a, it's a, it gets weird pretty quick, you know?
It does. It does. All of the above. I wish he was on this call too to empathize with that.
But Lena, we are conscious of your time, but we just want to say thank you so much for all the work that you do within this space, for putting your voice out there, for putting your beautiful writing out there. You know, you've really taught us a lot, certainly. Aww. And I know you teach a lot of our friends, well, pretty much everyone we know follows you, as should. And if they don't, hopefully they will after this episode. But yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
And we're going to put all of your information in our show notes. But I was also going to say, Lena, would you be able to tell our listeners right now where they can find you on the internet?
Yes. Well, first off, it's such an honor to witness both of your connection and thoughts about all of this. It's like, you know, when you're going on a poly podcast, you never know if you're going to be like in the hot take Thunderdome. So this is really, really lovely and pleasant, and I really admire the level-headedness you both bring to your work. This is so fun. I have work many places. The internet is gentrifying sex educators off of its major platforms, so people like us need to majorly diversify. So I have a lot of links. You can find everything in at linktree.com/askasub. It's linktr.ee/askasub. On Instagram, I'm askasub 2.0. On Substack, it's askasub.substack.com. I have a Patreon, which is how you get into that moderated Discord community. I find that the $6 a month level weeds out a lot of the creeps and looky-loos, and the people in there are really, really lovely and committed to community building. That's patreon.com/askasub. I also have online courses. I have Conscious Kink was my first course. It's if you have the desire to create some kind of power dynamic between dom and sub or switching partners, that is available at askasub.com/courses, as well as Sub Survival Guide, which is to take you from dreaming to doing. If you're like, I'm a sub, I think, but like, I don't know what my kinks are. I don't know how to play with these people. I don't know how to build my dating app profile. I don't know how to negotiate. I don't know how to do solo submission. All of those things, I'll guide you from top to bottom, be your kinky bestie that you may not have, and support you through that journey. So wherever people would like to meet me, wherever they're comfortable, I'm in all of the places, and I can't wait to connect with them.
Amazing. You're a legend, Lena. Thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we'll get to have another chat soon.
Yes, this is such a joy. Thank you both.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back on.
Yes, anytime.
Thanks for tuning in to the Evolving Love Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and leave a comment on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback and support fuels our passion, and together we're building a community of curiosity, kindness, and growth.
If you would like to show your support and are interested in accessing 2 extra podcast episodes each month, along with access to my exclusive writing, you can become a premium subscriber over at evolvingloveproject.substack.com. subscribe, comment, and let's keep the conversation going.